It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to a filmmaker who delved into the life and legacy of controversial Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy for a new PBS documentary airing tonight at 8. First, when it comes to the state of U.S. politics, what word would you use to describe what's going on? Polarization? Incivility? According to our next guest, those are too safe. She says hatred, in many cases, would be more accurate. In a piece she wrote in newspapers around the country, she said we finally started to hear that word a few weeks back. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was asked by a reporter for Sinclair Broadcast Group if the reason she's moving ahead with impeachment is that she hates President Trump.
And as a Catholic, I resent your using the word hate in a sentence that addresses me. I don't hate anyone. I was raised in a way that is full, a heart full of love, and always prayed for the president. And I still pray for the president. I pray for the president all the time. So don't mess with me when it comes to words like that.
Our guest says we seem to be in a state of high conflict, and when high conflict is left unchecked, we get the likes of the Middle East, Northern Ireland, and Sudan. But she says there is a solution. Amanda Ripley is a contributing writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow at the Emerson Collective. She's the author of The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way and The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why. Amanda, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, words like hate and high conflict, you say it's not hyperbole. You see people maybe on both sides of the political spectrum falling more and more into that category.
Well, one of the things I find really frustrating right now in when I read political coverage is that it doesn't talk enough about the psychology. When you get into a really intense us versus them conflict, which is also called high conflict, emotions matter way more than policy or facts or strategy or almost anything else. And so it feels to me like emotions should be part of how we analyze and understand and interpret what is going on politically. So, you know, I think Pelosi is right to recoil at the notion of hatred. And it's interesting to hear the ways in which she tries to keep hatred at bay through prayer. And I think that's a really fascinating conversation, right? Like, is this hatred? Is it not? What are the effects of hatred versus anger, which is much more productive generally than hatred? That to me is like really interesting and helps me understand the world that we're living in, as opposed to continually just going back and forth. You know, he said this, she said this about impeachment or Iran or any other number of conflicts. You need to talk about the emotions that are driving the behavior, which seems so baffling to each side.
It is a different thing to have someone say, I disagree with the people on the other side, but I think they're making a good faith effort. They're just coming to the wrong conclusions, to what you say we're seeing more of these days, which is the other side has nothing to offer. They don't have a valid opinion. I don't need to care what they think.
Right. So we know that about 40% of both Republicans and Democrats say that the other party is not just worse for politics, but that they're downright evil, right? So that's 40% as of 2017. That was research by Nathan Calamo and Liliana Mason. So that's a significant number. That's a change from past years. And so it's important that we talk about what that means. When you think people are inherently evil, you behave very differently than you do when you think people just are misinformed or making mistakes or doing the wrong thing. So that's a really interesting difference in the research between anger, say, and hatred. Aaron Halpern in Israel does some really fascinating research on this, and he's found that, you know, you can make peace agreements and make progress even when there's a lot of anger between different sides. Hatred, though, is very difficult. It tends to make conflict much, much worse and makes it go on much longer because of what you said, that there's a sense that it's immutable, that it can't be changed. Whereas anger says, hey, you're wrong. I'm right. I want to make you see my point of view, and assumes that we're still in some kind of relationship on this earth together.
And it seems like this could be a self-reinforcing loop. If I'm on side A, I'm going to look at those haters on side B who are in that category of people who dismiss side A and they represent all of that side. Then side B is going to look back at my side and so on and so forth. This could keep building on itself.
Exactly. It already is. So it's a sort of perpetual motion machine at this point. And that's what high conflict is. So everything you do to get out of the conflict, say, trying to impeach the president for the Democrats, or for the Republicans trying to convince Democrats, look at the economy, look at all this progress we're making in these different areas. Everything you do to try to convince the other side actually has the effect of making things worse. So that's a signature trait of a high conflict, that things just get worse and worse, and they're kind of on their own momentum. They have their own intelligence, the conflict. So that is a little bit scary, but it's also something that is changeable. You can disrupt high conflict just as you can other kinds of conflict. But you can't keep assuming that times are normal, that we just keep doing everything we always do and eventually we'll convince each other that we're right.
I want to get to that possible solution in just one moment, but I want to get to maybe the worst case here, that this situation of high conflict, of increasing mutual hatred, could lead to increasing acts of political violence.
Yeah. And I mean, we know this really well from other countries, and we're not different. If anything has become clear to me over the last few years, humans have very much in common when it comes to conflict all over the world. And so we have in some categories seen increases in political violence. We can expect to see more political violence as we approach the election and after the election, regardless of the result. Some of that violence will take the form of racial violence, anti-Semitic violence. Some of it will be much more directly political, violence against Republicans, violence against Democrats. And we can expect that, unfortunately, to increase. Now, that doesn't mean we can't do anything, right? But the problem is, once you have violence, it makes everyone frightened and angry and creates more hatred, right? So that leads to more violence. So you get back into that perpetual motion cycle that you were talking about. So there are things that can be done. We know that from experts who do this at work in other countries, many of whom have now turned their attention to the United States for all these reasons. But yeah, it is worrisome that, 5 to 15% of both Democrats and Republicans currently say they would support some level of violence against their political opponents. That's not a huge number of people, but it's enough. It's never a majority of people who support sectarian violence. It just takes a few.
Talk to Amanda Ripley, writer and author. She says we're past polarization in American politics. We're veering into hatred, into a state of high conflict. But she writes there are some solutions. Amanda, you lay out one suggestion that you even admit sounds naive, but it seems to work. What is it?
Yeah, I know. It sounds really just ridiculous, but just humor me for one second, because the evidence does support it. So it turns out when Americans read messages, say tweets, calling for peace and condemning political violence, they actually lower their support for political violence. So in other words, we are all influenced by one another. These are cultural norms. They're in flux right now. But when Americans, in the same research by Nathan Calmo and Liliana Mason, when they exposed Americans to a Trump tweet, which is a real treat, a tweet that came out a while ago, which was, "I condemn all types of racism and acts of violence, peace to all Americans." When they expose Americans of different parties to that tweet, the support for political violence goes down. The same is true when they expose Americans to a similar quote from Joe Biden, which his campaign posted after an Antifa attack on a conservative writer last year, in which he said violence directed at anyone because of their political opinions is never acceptable. So these kinds of things would sound so kind of obvious, like of course, are not obvious in this moment. When you get into high conflict, it needs to be said. It needs to be said not just by people in positions of power, but by regular people. And we know from the research that it has a calming effect, that people hear that. And that's good news.
Is it important that people call out not just the other side? It's easy to condemn the other side's act of violence, that people actually are talking to their own side when they make these recommendations for peace?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's much more important that people do this to their own side, because they're, people are not going to trust as much spokespeople from the other side. Yeah, so I think it's something everyone can do. Actually, in this research, which was really cool, even when random strangers called for peace in tweets, Americans in the study also responded well to that. So it doesn't need to be just, political pundits or politicians, although that would be great. And I strongly urge those people to get out ahead of this and condemn political violence right now before the election. But we don't need to wait for them, right? Which is the good news. Like, anyone can do this. And, obviously you're going to have more impact on the people people in your circle. And it may feel like something that goes without saying, but that's not actually the case anymore.
We're talking about the politics of polarization, high conflict, and hate in America with Amanda Ripley, contributing writer at The Atlantic and a senior fellow at the Emerson Collective. Her recent piece on hatred in our political system was published in newspapers around the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think America's politics are consumed by hate? Do you see this on the rise over the years? What do you see feeding into it? Do you see people giving the kind of messages that Amanda was just talking about, specifically saying, hey, let's not let this bleed over into violence. Let's take a peaceful approach to our politics. Have you done that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're talking about American politics, high conflict, and hatred with Amanda Ripley, contributing writer at The Atlantic, senior fellow at the Emerson Collective. Her piece on these topics appeared in the Washington Post and elsewhere. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this kind of division extending into hatred in America's political scene? Have you experienced it personally? Do you see it on social media, maybe even in person among people? Do you worry about where this could go? What do you see as a solution? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A lot of comments, Amanda, on the Facebook page there. Kevin writes, social media and the ability to be the keyboard warrior for your cause are two of the reasons we have such a divide. We've lost our ability or our reason to actually have personal interactions with others. Having those personal interactions, Kevin says, would go a long way in people tearing down the walls of hyper-partisanship. What do you think? Is there something about social media and a lack of a personal connection that might be helping drive this?
Yeah, I definitely think there's the effect of anonymity makes it much easier to demonize people, right? We know that from road rage, even before social media. So that's for sure true. Of course, in this research, we could see it works both ways, right? So when you tweet about condemning violence and treating people as complicated individuals rather than immutable evil monsters, then you can have this positive effect. So it is a little complicated in that sense. I would say, though, to Kevin's point, for sure, you know, there are lots of ways to try to combat the rise of hatred. Many, many ways at a collective level, at an individual level. Speaker Pelosi talked about using prayer in her own personal life to try to pray for the president. So instead of hating the president, whether that's true or not, that is definitely one useful strategy. Another is to have relationships with people that you disagree with. And to Kevin's point, we have fewer and fewer of those. People are not marrying or dating across the political divide as they were in my lifetime. These are very unusual times in the sense that people do not know and talk to one another across the political divide. So for me personally, what I do is reporting. Like, I get to go out and talk to people that I disagree with. And when I get to know them, I still disagree with many of the things that they tell me, but I see them as like three-dimensional people, and it makes it much harder to dismiss them en masse and demonize them. It's just a basic psychological reality is when you know people, it's harder to collapse into simplicity.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Joel is with us in Portage. Joel, hi.
Hello there. I just have a slight disagreement with the way that the author used anger. She described it as, you're wrong and I'm right, and I think that's only part of it. I think it's a common distortion. I think anger is really something like, this is what makes me mad, this is what makes me angry, and here's why. And it's not always the other person. And if we're able to clearly articulate what it is that we're upset about, then it stops being you and me or an us and them thing, and it becomes more ownership by the person really owning what their position is.
Joel, thanks for the call. And Amanda, I think Joel is closer to agreeing with you than he thinks. That's you saw anger as potentially a positive mode of politics, separate from this us and them hatred you're talking about.
Yeah, I like where Joel's going, though. I mean, I think, like, if I'm understanding him right, he's saying that, like, there are ways to do anger that are more or less destructive, right? And so I think that's right. There's a huge spectrum of ways that anger manifests itself, given certain conditions. So, yeah, there are ways to do anger that are really productive. And we need conflict. We need anger. Like, this is how we get better as a society, or as a family, or as a church, or a mosque, whatever. Like, we need to be able to disagree. Anger is very mobilizing. Usually, anger suggests that there's something underneath. There's some need that's not being met. Right. And it's important to probe into that. Like, what is that? It's important for us to do that as a country and also individually. So to me, this is the really interesting part of conflict. And I'm glad we're talking about it, because I think, I don't know about everyone else, but I just feel like I'm getting tired of reading news coverage that just goes back and forth like this endless tennis match of vitriol. Right. Like, I'm not getting anywhere. Like, I don't feel like I'm learning more about the world or myself or other people. So trying to understand what is the unmet need underneath the anger that we see is maybe more interesting and more productive. But yeah, in general, anger is not a bad thing. Hatred is qualitatively different, and tends to be very destructive, right, and can incite violence and other things. So I think it's an important distinction, you know, and one that I think is interesting to talk about out in the open rather than pretending it's not happening.
Joel, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Bridget with us in Green Bay. Bridget, hi.
Hi. So I'm married to a diehard Republican, and I am not. I am of the other persuasion, and it has become much harder over the last 3 years. Even we have become way more entrenched in our beliefs. So we've had to learn to compartmentalize those discussions, and we try really hard to always focus on the things that we love about each other. I always tell my husband one of the things he loves best about me is my bleeding heart. And, you know, it gets tough at times when certain things come up, and we've learned to not watch the news together. And, you know, he even has a cousin that is on the national Fox News, has his own show. And so we have to really separate those kinds of things in our life.
And Bridget, you said you've seen it getting harder to do this over the years, just because of how politics has changed?
Yeah, over the last 3 years, since the 2016 election, we've both kind of gone off on a different, well, not different, but more entrenched in our own camp, and it's harder for us to see that middle ground. And we've been together, between marriage and dating, we've been together 16 years, and these last 3 years have been actually much more polarizing for us than before that. It was never really an issue when we were dating. But it has definitely gotten harder over the last 3 years.
Bridget, thank you so much for sharing that story. Amanda, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think that we need more people like Bridget, basically, and her husband. I mean, I think we know from the research that people who live with people who disagree with them politically tend to have much more complicated and accurate views of the other side. And we know, I did a large project for The Atlantic a while back where we looked at, you know, who are the most politically prejudiced people in the country in the least. And one of the things we found is that people who live with and among people who are from the other political side are much less politically prejudiced, meaning they're less likely to hate the other side. So they disagree, right? And Bridget said that very clearly. Like, they still clearly disagree. And it sounds like it's not easy. And I can believe that. I can believe that. I think there should be free couples counseling for all. This is my platform if I'm running for office. Free couples counseling for everyone who disagrees politically. Because this is actually really, really important, because you start to see, oh, hey, actually, as much as I disagree with Republicans on welfare, let's say, I actually know my husband cares about poor people. It's just that he has a very different way of thinking you should help poor people. I'm just making this up, right? Mm. But like, and vice versa, whereas, you know, her husband appreciates Bridget's, it sounds like appreciates her compassion, her generosity of spirit, right? He thinks that maybe he thinks it's unrealistic, or maybe he thinks it goes too far in certain cases, but he can see that there's a place of good intentions in some of what she's saying, right? So that kind of thing is incredibly valuable in a polarized, high conflict situation like we're living in.
Bridget, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Amanda Ripley about polarization, hatred, and high conflict in American politics. Amanda, I wonder if you have some practical advice for the person who's at their phone or their computer keyboard. They're on social media. They see the comment from their cousin on the other side say they want to respond maybe with some anger, but not go into this this hatred, this high conflict mode. How do we do that?
Yeah, you know, I've been working on that as a reporter as well as a person. And it's one of the things I try to do is to get like super curious. Like, it's not always easy to do. But when I can get really curious, what I find is I can ask questions that reveal things to me that I wouldn't have known otherwise. And the conversation gets a lot more interesting. So, you know, try as much as possible to stay away from like the political talking points and ask about personal stories, like bring it very personal. So maybe you reveal something about your own personal story and ask with genuine curiosity about their story. And that's the hard thing, right, is to get curious, to not assume you know, to not assume all these cascading assumptions we make in conflict, right? So that takes a lot of practice. It's easier in certain situations than others. One of the questions, I have certain questions I keep like on a post-it on my wall in my office for interviews where I feel like we're going down this path of no return and I want to get curious. So I'll ask things like, which a mediation expert named Gary Friedman taught me, the question, what would it be like for you if you got what you wanted on this? Like, what would that look like? And try to get people to talk about not just about what they're against, but like what life would look like for them. And that's not something we talk about very often. We get very dug in on like what's wrong, but it can be a useful way to get people out of those out of the script and into a more interesting place.
Briefly, Amanda, do you have a sense of optimism that we can steer ourselves back out of this high conflict zone?
I think eventually. I mean, we certainly can do it. I don't see it happening soon. Like, I fear that it's going to get worse before it gets better. But I actually have a lot of confidence in most Americans. Like, I think a lot of this is being driven by extremes, by people with the biggest microphones, by people who are extremely partisan. We know that from the research. We know it from all kinds of things. Like I said, it's only 5 to 15% of Americans who endorse political violence against their opponents, right? So the problem is, like, how do we get the microphone back? Like, how do we have regular Americans who I think are mostly exhausted by the vitriol? How do we raise up their voices?
Amanda, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Amanda Ripley. You can keep this conversation about political anger and divide going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Iraq's parliament has voted in favor of a resolution to expel U.S. troops, and Iran says it won't follow key rules from the 2015 nuclear deal. We'll look at the fallout from the Trump administration's killing of a top Iranian general. First, a new PBS American Experience documentary delves into the life and legacy of controversial Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy, from his origins as a farm kid to lawyer to lawmaker. McCarthy served as Wisconsin senator in Washington, D.C. from 1947 until his death in 1957. His career will always be linked with the Cold War and his role in the Red Scare. Sharon Grimberg is the documentary filmmaker behind McCarthy. The documentary airs tonight at 8 as part of the PBS American Experience series. Sharon, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, we refer to Joseph McCarthy and the idea of McCarthyism a fair amount in American culture and politics, but it doesn't seem like we are really in touch with who he was and what he did anymore. Can you talk about why you wanted to tackle his life in this documentary?
Well, we started working on this documentary a very long time ago. The idea for it first came about in 2003 when the transcripts from the executive sessions of his hearings were released. And we thought that would be a good opportunity to delve back in and figure out who he was and to see if the transcripts provided any new insights. And in some ways they do. They show us how he operated. They give insight to who he decided to put in front of cameras and bring up in public sessions. So that was the initial idea for making the series. And for one reason or another, it got put off for a long time. We sort of looked at it and thought about it. And then I did do some interviews fortunately, in early 2016 with some people who knew McCarthy personally, either a journalist who covered him when he was in the Senate and a couple of people whose lives were connected to his because of his interrogations. So it's been in the works for a very long time.
Well, looking at his rise in politics, this was somebody, as you reveal in the documentary, who wasn't afraid to take on entrenched people, a local judge to start, Robert La Follette Jr., son of fighting Bob La Follette in a Senate primary. In many ways, he hustled and came out of nowhere to get these positions.
Yeah, you have to admire him. He came from a very humble background. He worked incredibly hard from the very beginning to get where he was, first as a judge and then, as a senator. And he did take on some very formidable opponents and for a while was pretty successful. So you have to give him a lot of credit for that, I think. And I also think that he was very loyal to his roots and to his family and background and his community throughout his career, even when he was very successful and a senator in D.C.
Another less positive theme that emerges is taking raw material that is grounded in reality, a legitimate fear of the spread of communism in the world, his actual service volunteering in World War II, but then taking that to basically fabricating stories above and beyond all of that. Can you talk about how he did that?
Well, so there was a legitimate fear in the early 1950s about communism. And there had been a number of very high profile cases in the US of communist infiltration of the government. So he took these fears, and some of them were legitimate fears, and what he did was he was very reckless. He accused people of doing things that they clearly had not done. And he preyed, actually, on a lot of people who were quite powerless and who were not important in federal government or didn't have much power or access to power. So a lot of the people he interrogated and brought back up in front of his committees were, for example, engineers at the Voice of America. Some of them were people who had worked in American military installations who had then gone on to become school teachers or, engineers. They were not powerful people. And he really traumatized people. Many people lost their jobs. One Voice of America engineer actually committed suicide when he was threatened with, or he was worried that he was going to have to testify before McCarthy's committee.
You start the documentary with a pivotal moment in McCarthy's career before you delve back into his early days. He's the junior senator from Wisconsin. He is not a high-profile politician nationally. He's at a very small local, I think it was a Lincoln Day talk, and that's where he pulls out this idea that, hey, he has a piece of paper with a list of a couple hundred communists in the State Department. Can you talk about that moment and how it captured him a national profile?
Yeah, so in early 1950, his career wasn't going that well. He had managed to alienate many people in the Senate by being kind of disrespectful and not honoring the rules of the Senate. And he'd supported some very unpopular positions in his first years in the Senate. And so his career was not looking good, and he was worried about prospects of re-election in 1952. And he went to Wheeling, West Virginia, to talk to a women's Republican organization there. And he went with this speech, hoping to sort of garner some attention about the fact that the State Department was infiltrated with communists, and he claimed to have this list of 208 names of communists who were working in the State Department. And that's quite an explosive claim at the time. It wasn't recorded, the speech was not recorded, but there happened to be a local newsman there at the speech, and he reported it, and it got picked up by the Associated Press and was published around the country, which garnered him a lot of attention. And he was very excited by that attention. And that really kind of reinvigorated his career.
Talking to Sharon Grimberg, creator of the documentary McCarthy, which is airing as part of the PBS American Experience series. Senator McCarthy wasn't the only person on this anti-communist crusade. There was his colleagues in the House, on the House Un-American Committee were doing similar things. What made him and his name the synonym for what people later called the Red Scare or the witch hunts?
Yeah, so McCarthy didn't invent any of the tactics of what's been come to know as McCarthyism or the Red Scare. He kind of, as one of my advisors, one of my interviews said, he became the demagogue of anti-communism. He was the most reckless and also, the most unending interrogator. I mean, he interrogated hundreds of people over the course of 14 months, holding endless hearings. And he wasn't very concerned with who he hauled up in front of his committee or how accurate any accusations were. He handed his staff stacks of unsigned subpoenas so they could call in almost anybody they wanted to in front of the committee. So he was just very reckless and careless of the witnesses who appeared before him.
And that we should highlight that list of 200 plus communists in the State Department. Did it exist?
It was based on some very old information about people who had been suspected a few years earlier of having either been involved in some front organization or having some link to a union that was infiltrated or dominated by communists. And he had no idea whether those people were still employed by the State Department, whether they'd been cleared and allowed to stay. It was very outdated information and incorrect information.
So he rose quickly to national prominence. You cover his whole career in the documentary. Can you talk about his rapid fall from that prominence?
Well, so he rises very quickly, becomes really well known around the country and very popular with a lot of people because they felt he was protecting national security by hunting out communists in government. And then he takes on the U.S. Army. And at this point, Eisenhower is in the White House. And Eisenhower is very upset. He treats Army generals with complete disrespect. And this is a point with Eisenhower, who'd been loath to be too outspoken about McCarthy, really behind the scenes helps to engineer McCarthy's downfall. And he is actually the subject of interrogations himself and hearings over the summer of 1954 around his behavior and the behavior of two key aides in relation to the Army. It's a very complicated story, but as a result of those hearings, he is censured by his colleagues in this, and that really leads to him having very little influence anymore in the Senate.
Looking back, I mean, McCarthy explodes into prominence. He makes this wild, exaggerated claim. It goes viral. Doing this project, do you wonder what Joseph McCarthy might have been able to do with the internet?
Oh, gosh. There's all sorts of things that are interesting about the time, because I think that at the time, the country was very polarized. And even after McCarthy was censured, he still had polling figures showed that 30% of the country or more still supported him. And so I think that he was able to claim so much of the national attention because he did have the attention of the media. He would say something and the press would report it. He kind of dominated. Would it be different today? Probably it would be different today. But at the same time, I think maybe the people he accused would have had greater access to influencing the public too, and would have been able to respond with social media for themselves. Whereas at the time, they didn't have the same kind of access to reporters and the media that he did.
We'll leave it there for now. Sharon, thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you so much for your interest.
Sharon Grimberg is a documentary filmmaker. Her latest project is McCarthy, which looks at the Wisconsin senator at the center of the Red Scare in the 1950s. The documentary airs tonight at 8 as part of the PBS American Experience series. Coming up, Democrats are moving to rein in the president's war powers after President Trump ordered an airstrike last week, killing a top Iranian general. We'll look at how Congress is reacting to the death of Qasem Soleimani. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. What used to be a booming industry in Wisconsin is now in decline. At least one analyst says more tough times lie ahead. We'll look at the state of frac sand mining in the state coming up. First, European Union officials will hold an emergency meeting Friday after Iran announced it will end at least some of its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal. That comes as the world continues to react to the U.S. airstrike last week that killed top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. As the Iraqi government appears to be on the verge of expelling U.S. troops from the country, the Trump administration has said that Soleimani was planning an imminent attack that could have killed Americans. Yesterday, with Margaret Brennan of CBS, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo declined to say whether or not there was still a risk of that kind of attack.
So Iran can still carry out that specific threat you described as imminent. Is it still imminent?
Margaret, we continue to prepare for whatever it is the Iranian regime may put in front of us within the next 10 minutes, within the next 10 days, and within the next 10 weeks. We are focused on delivering a strategy for the American people. We're going to get it right in a moment, but we're more importantly going to get it right over the days and weeks and months ahead.
Dalia Fahmy is an associate professor of political science at Long Island University in Brooklyn. Dalia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Have we heard more details about what the Trump administration has said was an imminent attack led by Soleimani?
No, unfortunately, we haven't. And that's part of the crisis that we're in right now, because what we saw over the weekend is the Iraqi parliament vote to work towards ending the presence of all foreign troops on Iraqi soil, which is the wording of their bill. The interesting thing about this bill is it's not a binding resolution. It's a non-binding resolution passed by the Iraqi parliament with support of much of the Shia clerics of Iraq. Now, the interesting thing, if we take a wider step back about what's been happening locally in Iraq over the past couple of weeks, is that there have been pro-democracy protests. Now, that, in its essence, has been suspended to deal with what's happening today, which is seen as an impingement on the sovereignty of Iraq because of the airstrike that killed Qasem Soleimani and others in Iraq. And so what's happening in Iraq today is counter to the interest of the Democratic push, but also counter to U.S. interest.
Right. Some of those protests, those pro-democracy protests, in part, as I understand it, Dalia, were targeted at Iran's influence in Iraq. Do I have that right?
Yes. And so you had pro-democracy protests happening inside of Iraq, pro-democracy protests happening inside of Iran. And in both countries, those protests have been replaced with pro-regime alliances. We saw yesterday the streets of Iran, not just Tehran, but streets all over Iran flooded with mourners of Qasem Soleimani's death. And it's not so much that they were mourning the actual death as much as this is seen as Iranian people coming into the street to support their country. And so what you're seeing in Iraq and Iran today is pro-democracy protests replaced with high nationalist symbolic movements.
We've seen a letter apparently going out from the U.S. military to Iraqi military leaders that said the U.S. would be moving troops, getting them ready for a change of their deployment, possibly withdrawal. I think I was just seeing a statement that, no, that was a draft. That's not the real deal. What do we know about U.S. strategy and where our troops are in Iraq right now?
Yes, we did see this letter that was announcing the onward movement of U.S. troops, withdrawing and telling the Iraqi military that they would see increased air power as troops were withdrawn. And then just within the last half hour, we saw, this was a draft that should not have been released. But what we're seeing is the unfortunate result of the thinning of the national security team of President Trump. You're seeing the foreign policy in the Middle East, or U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, becoming increasingly unpredictable. And so when you have, for example, the president tweeting out twice that he would attack 52 historic sites in Iran if the Iranian regime were to do anything. Well, we know that this is against international law. It's also against the 1954 Hague Convention that protects historical sites. And so technically, the president has tweeted out twice in the past 2 days that he would commit war crimes. And yet the accusation is that Qasem Soleimani was a war criminal. And so when you have the United States no longer seen as a partner of stability or a beacon of stability in the region, rather the U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East, especially in Iran and Iraq today and in Syria earlier, late last year, is becoming increasingly unpredictable. Now, when the president said yesterday, if the Iraqis want us to withdraw, if they actually follow through on their vote, well, then they have to pay for the air base in Baghdad. Well, they did follow through on their vote, and then we saw this leaked or unofficial release of this document saying that, well, we're going to withdraw anyway. Now, we have to remember that the United States just withdrew from the air base in northern Syria, and right away the Russian military took over that air base. And so what we're seeing is that the United States' behavior becoming increasingly unclear is leading to much more instability in the region.
Talking to Dalia Fahmy from Long Island University in Brooklyn with the latest in the aftermath of the targeted killing of the Iranian general Soleimani and what's happened just in the few days since. It seems like a lot longer somehow. Dalia, also we're seeing from NATO, our European allies, and the U.S., it sounds like anti-ISIS operations in Iraq are being dialed back now amidst all this.
Anti-ISIS operations are being dialed back because of the instability in the region. ISIS, anti-ISIS operations in northern Syria have been dialed back. We've even seen a call for diplomatic retraction from many NATO leader countries to remove their diplomatic corps from several areas in the Middle East, namely Iraq and Iran, and just because of the unpredictability. And so this targeted assassination of a military leader, whether he, you know, of course, we can all agree that he was conducting operations that killed thousands upon thousands of people. But this is seen as a military leader, second highest in command in Iran, being killed in another sovereign country is deemed as an act of war by many people in the region. And so when you see that the United States is creating this moment where Iran, which had been constrained in the past couple of years, is now seemingly stronger and able to leverage power more than it has been able to. Now, if you think about, for example, what happened when the U.S. Reneged on the Iran nuclear deal, technically, Iran was supposed to be compressed and controlled in its capacity for 15 years. And the argument of the Trump administration was, well, 15 years, and then they can become stronger again. What we're seeing is that Iran is in a stronger position today in capability and capacity and able to project power in the region more so than ever before. It is actually in Iran's interest that the U.S. withdraw troops from Iraq. It is actually in Iran's interest that the U.S. withdraw troops from northern Syria. And so as a consequence of unthought out of an unvisionary positioning of U.S. foreign policy, it's put Iran in an actual position where it's stronger and has greater entrenchment in the region. And with this latest vote of Iraqis the Iraqi parliament, who is seen as loyal to the United States, basically kicking us out through their vote, even though it's non-binding, you're seeing that the United States is no longer seen as welcome. Rather, it's seen as weakening the region as a whole. And so let's rid ourselves of them. This is not in the best interest of the United States. It's not in the best interest of our NATO allies, but it's also going to lead to a more unstable region and a stronger footprint for Iranian power.
Dalia, in our last 30 seconds or so, what are you watching for next?
We're watching to see if these troops, the 82nd Airborne that's been deployed, what does that mean? Because what we do know is that even though Iran's big picture capability is actually growing, and the United States might have to say we're withdrawing our military, in order for us to actually have an eye on the region, we actually might have to deploy more troops. And so the language of withdrawing troops from Iraq might have to be replaced with deploying more troops to the region at large.
Dalia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Dalia Fahmy, Associate Professor of Political Science at Long Island University in Brooklyn. She joined us today to talk about the continued fallout from a U.S. airstrike last week, killing top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Details are changing by the minute in some cases with statements from the U.S., Iran, Iraq, and other allies today. Keep on top of that at npr.org and tune into our news coming up in just a couple of minutes. Work can be stressful no matter what kind of job you do, but a small study says you might be able to find some relaxation by putting a houseplant in your workspace. Researchers in Japan got out of the lab and into some actual workplaces. They measured the workers' stress levels, in particular their pulse. Then they supplied them with plants. The workers were told that, hey, whenever you feel tired or fatigued, you just spend a few minutes looking at the plant. And when the workers had the plants and took the time to interact with them, their pulse rates went down and their anxiety levels went down too. It's a small study, but maybe worth looking into. Was it really the plants, or was it just that, you know, the practice of taking a few minutes to turn away from work that made people feel more relaxed? Well, I asked around Wisconsin Public Radio. I found a few people with houseplants. Judith Sears Poisson has a couple plants in her office. She says she finds them soothing and, quote, I get a sense of accomplishment that they didn't die. There are some plants in my office, but they are not mine. Kate Archer Kent has a couple, and she says she does find them relaxing. Confession, I hadn't really consciously noticed the plants before. To be fair, I usually have my back to them the way the office is set up. I tried, though, staring at the plants for a while this afternoon. I just felt kind of silly. Should get some plants here in this, well, windowless studio. Yeah, I don't think those would do too well. Plant news you can use. This is Central Time.